Faith is believing in something you can't see, you can't feel, something that can't be proven.
So then how do you know which is the right faith?
I think that's a gut thing.
I don't think about a right faith. I think about what resonates with me. I feel authentic. It brings me peace.
I think there is no absolute truth in any religion. I think it's a matter of subjective experience.
I kind of just trust my intuition, trust my gut.
You just know. You just gotta follow it.
You just gotta follow what you think is your faith.
If faith is blind, then what makes one belief better or worse than any other? And if it's just a leap in the dark, why should any of us feel obligated to believe anything at all? My name is Shane Rosenthal. I was raised in a Jewish home, but became an atheist at a very young age. Later, as I began to question things, I ended up losing faith in my atheism and converted to Christianity. Since that time, I've never stopped asking questions, and I've spoken with authors and scholars from all over the world in order to explore the beliefs and ideas that shape our lives. Over the years, one thing I've concluded is this. We're all believers. But because there are so many conflicting ideas and worldviews out there, we just can't all be right. So how do we find the truth? On this podcast, we'll start by asking questions.
I'm really just trying to figure out what I believe right now.
Hey there, and welcome to another episode of the Humble Skeptic Podcast. On this episode, I'll be taking a deeper dive into the subject I explored on the last episode with Richard Baucom, related to the authorship of the Fourth Gospel. Throughout most of my Christian life, I assumed with everyone else I knew that the Gospel of John had been written by the Apostle John. Though this is a common assumption, as I began to study this Gospel closely over the last decade, I discovered that John, the son of Zebedee, is nowhere identified as the author of this text, and that a good deal of internal and external evidence actually points in other directions. It's important to note up front that this is not merely an academic question, particularly since the author of this gospel claims to have been a key witness to events in the life of Jesus. In fact, he provides us with important details related to Jesus' crucifixion that were not recorded in the synoptic gospels. Therefore, if this author's testimony is to be regarded as authentic, then we need to provide a general account of his identity and background in order to assess the credibility of his claims. In numerous verses throughout the fourth gospel, one of Jesus' disciples is specifically identified as the disciple whom Jesus loved. It's important for us to notice that this particular individual is never named. More importantly, we also need to recognize that this disciple unmistakably identifies himself as the author of this gospel. In John 21:24, he writes, quote, "This is the disciple who is bearing witness about these things and who has written these things, and we know that his testimony is true." Alan Culpepper wisely observes that the beloved disciple emerges in the fourth gospel as the disciple closest to Jesus. He's the one who reclined at the breast of Jesus at the Last Supper, the one to whom Jesus gave his mother at his death, the first of the disciples to reach the empty tomb, and the first to believe in the resurrection. This provides us with a good summary of the beloved disciple's privileged position, but the fact that he was especially loved by Jesus, along with the fact that he reclined at his breast during the Last Supper, sometimes strikes modern readers as more than a little odd. In fact, in the 1984 film Mass Appeal, starring Jack Lemmon and Charles Durning, the suggestion was made that Jesus and John may in fact have been same-sex attracted.
I want Argentina. Eileen thinks Scandinavia. Which do you prefer?
Let me take these home and I'll decide right away.
Huh? Tim, are you trying to get out of this meeting?
Oh, come on, Tom. I made the first three.
Why did you expel Frank and Alfred?
If you'd care to make an appointment...
Why'd you expel them?
They're taking a leave of absence.
For how long?
You're in no position to question me.
They were friends.
How do you know that's all they were?
I talked to them.
Then you know they were in love.
I know. They were serious about their vows.
For now. I can't be sure that in 8 or 10 years they still would be. As you know, the tricky thing about priests is that they can only live with other men.
Jesus and St. John dealt with it.
I hope you're not saying what I think you're saying.
As you know, St. John always referred to himself as the one whom Jesus loved. During the Last Supper, John rested his head upon Christ's chest. I'm sure if you saw that, both of them would be taking a leave of absence, too.
Christ was God.
Christ was also a man, and he asked for love. And whether you like it or not, love doesn't always flow in comfortable little channels that make it easy for homophobic autocrats to make decisions.
This, in my opinion, is a good example of eisegesis, where an idea is read into the text. What we need instead is exegesis, in which a given passage is read and interpreted according to its original first century context. So, how should we then interpret these verses that speak of a disciple of Jesus who was especially loved and who reclined at his breast? In the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, Jesus tells the story of a poor man who died and who was carried by the angels to Abraham's side. In its first century context, sitting at the side of a person of higher rank or nobility was indicative of one's elevated status. Jesus uses similar language in John 1:18 when he says, "No one has ever seen God, the only God who is at the Father's side. He has made him known." In previous generations, the Greek word used here for side, which is kolpos, was often rendered bosom, which is why the King James Version spoke of Abraham's bosom, along with the fact that the Son is, quote, in the bosom of the Father. Jesus is, therefore, not only the Father's beloved Son, but according to numerous texts, both in the Old and New Testaments, he's also the one who is seated at God's right hand. What's remarkable about the fourth gospel, however, is that the language used to describe Jesus' privileged position with the Father is the same language used by the author of this text to convey his unique relationship with Jesus. According to John 13:23, one of his disciples whom Jesus loved was reclining at table at Jesus' side. Therefore, just as Jesus is especially loved by the Father, so too this disciple is especially loved by Jesus. And just as Jesus is at the Father's side and makes him known, so too the beloved disciple is at Jesus' side and makes him known in the pages of his gospel. This language is so striking that it's somewhat hard to believe. If one of Jesus' disciples really had been privileged in this way, is it plausible that his name would be completely left out of the record? Perhaps, therefore, we should consider the possibility that this text is really a work of fiction. The great 19th century Cambridge scholar and chaplain to Queen Victoria, J.B. Lightfoot, faced this question head-on and concluded that the evidence actually points in the opposite direction. Responding to the liberal critics of the fourth gospel in his day, he writes, quote, "Looking carefully at this text, we find that an anonymous person appears and reappears in the narrative. He is the disciple whom Jesus loved, and sometimes simply the other disciple. The fact that he is never named is the more remarkable considering that he is a very important and prominent character." Lightfoot then concludes by saying that this approach is, quote, "wholly unlike that of a forger. The apocryphal gospels declare at their opening in the most explicit terms who was the author. This is not only unlike a forger, it's wholly unintelligible on such a supposition," end quote. Lightfoot's point is easily grasped when we consider the fact that the later fictional stories about Jesus, such as we find in the Gnostic Gospels, were claimed to have been written by a variety of Jesus' known disciples, which is why they appear with titles such as the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Judas, or the Gospel of Mary. But why would anyone write a fictional story about Jesus by an anonymous disciple? The very fact that the beloved disciple is anonymous, argued 20th century German theologian Oscar Coleman, does suggest that he was a historical figure. But if the beloved disciple isn't a fictional character, but a real person of history, then again we should ask, why was his name kept out of the record? I'd like you to keep this question in the back of your mind for the moment as we take a look at some important details of the fourth gospel. In John 15:27, those who were present with Jesus at the Last Supper were specifically appointed to be his witnesses, since according to Jesus, they were the ones who had been with him from the beginning. Notice the way Peter emphasizes his role as an eyewitness in the sermon he preached before a Gentile audience in Caesarea. Quote, "We are witnesses of all that he did. They put him to death by hanging him on a tree, but God raised him up on the third day and made him appear, not to all the people, but to us who had been chosen by God as witnesses." In the same way, the beloved disciple highlights his eyewitness role during the dark hour of Jesus' crucifixion. "He who saw it," he says, "has borne witness, and his testimony is true." As Richard Bauckham points out in his book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, Already in the prologue, the author speaks as one of the eyewitnesses, and so readers know from the beginning that this narrative comes with a strong eyewitness claim. And the carefully staged conclusion brings them finally to the revelation that the beloved disciple is the principal witness and author, end quote. One thing that's intriguing about the final chapter of John's Gospel is the fact that though seven disciples are present with Jesus, only five are named. And by the end of the chapter, we discover that the beloved disciple, who is revealed to be the author of the Gospel, is one of the seven. In the opening verses of this chapter, we're told that Jesus revealed himself in this way to his disciples: Simon Peter, Thomas called the Twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. Now, if the Apostle John is the author of this text, his inclusion of the sons of Zebedee is his only clear reference to himself and his brother James. Another option to consider, however, is that the beloved disciple is one of the two unnamed disciples mentioned at the end of verse 2. Now, the disciple Jesus loved appears again in verse 7, and yet he remains unnamed. The same thing happens again in verses 20 to 24. Essentially, the beloved disciple is never identified, but remains hidden under a cloak of anonymity until the very end. Because this disciple is unequivocally identified as the author in verse 24, the implication seems to be clear. The person who wrote the fourth gospel is not one of the five named disciples, but instead should be identified as one of the two unnamed disciples. One reason the author chose to identify himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved could, in my opinion, be related to an important scene that takes place in John 19, 26 and 27. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing near the cross, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Then he said to his disciple, "Behold your mother." The beloved disciple is the one who was entrusted with the care and protection of Jesus' mother Mary. Therefore, if this fact was known in the earliest Christian community, which it likely was, then perhaps we could suggest that this is why he became known as the disciple Jesus loved. It was the result of this particular honor and responsibility. If this is the case, references in the fourth gospel to the beloved disciple, which seem obscure to us, may not have been obscure to the author's original Christian audience, although they may have been somewhat cryptic and veiled to outsiders. Now, if the Apostle John is equated with a beloved disciple, one question we could ask relates to the kind of care that he would have been able to provide for Mary. All four Gospels make clear that Jesus prepared the 12 for a life of suffering on account of his name. He told them that they would be hated by all men, persecuted from town to town, flogged in the synagogues, and in some cases, killed. In fact, James and his brother John were specifically told that they would drink the same cup that Jesus himself was about to drink, which was a clear prophecy of martyrdom for both the sons of Zebedee. According to Acts 12, John's brother James was killed by Herod sometime in the early 40s, and though most of us are familiar with stories about the Apostle John living until the late 1st century, in his book The Identity of John the Evangelist, Dean Furlong argues that, quote, early evidence supportive of John's late natural death is relatively sparse compared to that of John's early martyrdom. Part of his thesis includes the idea that there were two important characters named John in the early church, whose names and stories ended up being conflated over time. Now, if the Apostle John was the one charged with caring for Mary, how would he have been able to fulfill this responsibility? Why would Jesus place his mother in the care of one whose calling involved a lifetime of hatred, persecution, long absences, and eventual martyrdom? Why didn't he instead entrust his mother to the care of his immediate family members? But according to John 19, Jesus gave this responsibility to the beloved disciple, and from that hour, he took her to his own home. Taken as a whole, this passage and others like it seem to fit better with a Jerusalem-based disciple who had the means to care for Mary and to provide her safe harbor throughout the rest of her life. One issue that is difficult to explain by advocates of the traditional view is the fact that the Apostle John's presence at Golgotha was never hinted at by any of the other gospel writers. In fact, according to Matthew and Mark, the night Jesus was arrested, all the disciples left him and fled. This was a direct fulfillment of Jesus' words stated earlier that evening when he said, "You will all fall away because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered." All three synoptic gospels indicate that the women who followed Jesus from Galilee stood at a distance and observed Jesus' crucifixion, but none of the 12 disciples were ever mentioned. So if the Apostle John had been present, as the fourth gospel indicates in the traditional view, why then did Matthew, Mark, and Luke fail to mention this? As mentioned on the last two episodes, Richard Baucom points out a curious feature of Mark's gospel at this point in his narrative. Since those who were specifically appointed to be Jesus' witnesses simply weren't around to observe any of the details related to the events of Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, a noticeable shift takes place in which Mark introduces several female disciples who end up providing their own eyewitness testimony in the absence of the apostles. But given the significance placed on the beloved disciples' testimony there at the cross, if he is to be equated with the Apostle John, why wouldn't any other evangelist record his presence there? After all, Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection were at the heart of his mission, and John was an inspired witness who had been specifically commissioned by Jesus to testify to all that he had seen. So why would the other evangelists ignore his testimony and choose instead to include the reports of Jesus' female disciples, particularly in a culture that didn't value the testimony of women? When I put this question to Lydia McGrew, she responded by offering a challenge of her own.
As far as why they didn't mention him as a witness, I believe that Baucom and those who argue from that have the exact same problem themselves. If he was this person who was important to the early church, he was the disciple Jesus loved, he was in that sense an important witness, I think the very same question arises. Why don't they mention this disciple at the foot of the cross in the synoptics? Well, people just don't mention things sometimes.
While I certainly agree with Dr. McGrew that this argument cuts both ways, I'm convinced that my view of the authorship question happens to answer this objection. I'm not, however, persuaded by the argument that Matthew, Mark, and Luke simply failed to mention John's presence at Golgotha. In my opinion, this line of reasoning raises more questions than it solves. To see this, we need to take a close look at the events that led to Jesus' crucifixion, beginning with his arrest. After Jesus was bound and led by the soldiers to the residence of the high priest, the Synoptic Gospels tell us that Peter followed from a distance, all the way to the courtyard, which he then entered. According to John 18, however, Peter wasn't alone, but was accompanied by another disciple, who is believed by most conservative scholars to be the Apostle John. But we should ask, why has John effectively been written out of this scene by the other Gospel writers? Why would that even be necessary? What's particularly odd is that according to John's gospel, Peter wasn't even able to enter the courtyard on his own, since the high priest's gate was guarded. In other words, it's clear that the Synoptic Gospels haven't given us the full story, but since Peter's presence in the courtyard requires some kind of explanation, why should the other gospel writers leave John out of their accounts, particularly when he provides the solution? It's one thing to mention a single angel when two are present, but it's another thing entirely to mention a single disciple when two are required. Though this may seem strange, as we'll see, this is where the story gets really interesting. In my opinion, John 18 provides the strongest evidence against the traditional view of authorship. Verse 15 tells us that Peter followed behind Jesus, along with another disciple. Since this disciple was known to the high priest, this verse goes on to say that he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. Now, some have suggested that because the unnamed disciple who appears in this scene is not specifically identified as the disciple Jesus loved, it could be a different disciple altogether. However, when all the evidence is taken into consideration, it becomes increasingly clear that the person who is known to the high priest is none other than the beloved disciple himself, and thus the author of the gospel. There are several reasons for concluding this. First, this other disciple is an anonymous character who has just been with Jesus earlier that evening, which fits well with the beloved disciple. Second, in this chapter, an unnamed disciple has an advantage over Peter, which fits an overall pattern related to Peter and the beloved disciple. Third, in John 19:26, the beloved disciple is present at Golgotha, which makes sense if he is the other disciple who continued following Jesus from chapter 18 onward. Finally, in verse 2 of John 20, after discovering the empty tomb, Mary Magdalene ran to tell Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved. In short, the other disciple, here in this verse, is specifically identified as the beloved disciple. Most contemporary New Testament scholars, therefore, even among those who take the traditional view of authorship, conclude that the unnamed disciple of John 18 is the beloved disciple, and thus the author of the gospel. However, this identification raises a host of additional questions, such as, is it likely that John the son of Zebedee could have been known to the high priest? Over 100 years ago, Henry Barclay Sweet commented that it is scarcely conceivable that a Galilean disciple drawn from the fishermen of the northern lake could have stood in this relation to the head of the exclusive aristocracy which virtually ruled the Jewish people. This disciple, whoever he was, must have been a person of some wealth and influence, possibly of the family of high priests. John Calvin wrote something similar nearly four centuries earlier. What intimacy with the proud high priest could John have had, who was a lowly fisherman? And how was it possible for him, being one of Christ's household, to be in the habit of visiting the house of the high priest? Calvin therefore concluded that it was much more likely that he was not one of the 12. But if this is granted, and if John 18:15 is also seen as a reference to the beloved disciple, the necessary conclusion is that the author of the fourth gospel was not the Apostle John. So let's think this through carefully. This other disciple who was originally with Peter in the garden arrived first at the residence of the high priest, and surprisingly, John 18:15 tells us that he entered the courtyard with Jesus. When Peter finally arrived, we're told that this same disciple went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. The fact that he went out implies that he had actually gone inside the high priest's residence and that he has now stepped back outside into the courtyard once again. But why would a disciple of Jesus be allowed to enter into the residence of the high priest, particularly during an unauthorized late-night trial such as this? And why would he have the authority to allow Peter into the courtyard? According to John 18, he had the authority to do these things because he was known to the high priest. At this point, we should recall that at the time of Jesus' arrest, all the disciples fled the scene, and one of them was seized. According to Mark, this young man ended up escaping by slipping out of his linens and running off naked. John 18:19 also tells us that the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples. It appears, therefore, that Jesus' followers went into hiding for good reason, and had any of them declared their allegiance that night by entering with Jesus into the high priest's residence, more likely than not, they too would have been arrested and interrogated. In short, there's definitely something special about this disciple who was known to the high priest. In his classic study of this issue, German New Testament scholar Martin Hengel observed that, quote, "There are too many historical reasons against supposing that the gospel was composed by John the son of Zebedee. This gospel cannot come from a Galilean fisherman. The balance of the activity is shifted completely to Jerusalem. That the author comes from the upper class in Jerusalem could follow from the marked aristocratic character of the work. The relatively few people who have dealings with Jesus belong to the upper class. Mention should also be made of the mysterious other disciple in John 18, who gains direct access to the palace of Annas because he was well acquainted with him or was a friend of his. In the scenes in the high priest's palace and by the cross, we might consider whether here features have not entered in of a disciple who did not belong to the group of the 12, but to the priestly aristocracy in Jerusalem." End quote. Hengel's insight seems to make sense of this odd chapter in the Gospel of John. How did this disciple have the authority to enter with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest without fear? He could do this because he was a member of the high priest's circle, or perhaps even a relative. This could also explain how he had the authority to grant Peter access to the courtyard in the middle of the night, and why he seemed to be able to come and go as he pleased. If you think about it, this hypothesis could also make sense of the beloved disciple's anonymity. According to the Synoptic Gospels, Joseph of Arimathea was a rich man and a respected member of the Sanhedrin. But as John 19:38 informs us, he also happened to be a secret disciple of Jesus. Though he had not consented to the council's decision and actions, Luke tells us, out of fear, he kept his views to himself until the moment that he took courage and went to Pilate asking for the body of Jesus. Perhaps this way of looking at the situation could account for the actions of the beloved disciple as well. If he was a member of the high priestly circle, he certainly would have felt the pressure to keep his views about Jesus to himself. I believe my own experience is relevant here. When I first became a Christian back in 1985, my father very sternly instructed me not to talk about Jesus during an upcoming visit with our Jewish relatives. And out of fear in those early days, regretfully, I complied. So let's suppose that the beloved disciple was a young man who, like myself, attempted to share his views with intimate members of his family, but was continually rebuffed and warned not to speak of such things, since it could result in his being ejected from the synagogue and stripped of his authority. Perhaps he ended up complying with this arrangement for a time, and later included himself in the indictment recorded in John 12:42, which says, "Many even of the authorities believed in him, but out of fear they did not confess it, for they loved the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God." Another possibility, of course, could be that from the very beginning, Jesus specifically instructed the beloved disciple to keep a low profile. A member of the high priestly circle could serve as an important ally, and since such a man would have been a member of the upper class, perhaps we could also see him as the owner of the home in Jerusalem, with its large upper room in which Jesus celebrated the Last Supper with his disciples. If we take the beloved disciple to be a member of the high priest's circle or possibly a kinsman, this could explain another curious feature of the fourth gospel. John 18:10 informs us that at the time of Jesus' arrest, Peter drew his sword and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear.
Ow!
The servant's name, we're told, was Malchus. This scene also appears in the other three gospels, but with an important difference. In these accounts, names were left out of the record. In my opinion, this is a clear instance of protective anonymity, which is something we discussed on the last two episodes. New Testament scholar Gerd Thiessen was the first to coin the phrase, and commenting on John 18:10, he writes, quote, "It seems to me that the motive for this anonymity is not hard to guess. The one who draws his sword commits no minor offense when he cuts off someone's ear. As long as the high priest's slave was alive, it would have been inopportune to mention names. Their anonymity is for their protection." Thiessen then went on to argue that, quote, "Only in Jerusalem was there a reason to draw a cloak of anonymity over followers of Jesus who had endangered themselves by their actions." As I've mentioned, Richard Bauckham gives numerous examples of protective anonymity in his book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, such as the story of Lazarus. Because Jesus raised him from the dead and so many people were following Jesus as a result, John 12 tells us that the chief priests sought to put him to death. As a result, more than likely, he went into hiding, which is probably why Matthew, Mark, and Luke chose not to tell his story. Protective anonymity, therefore, suggests that the Gospels were written at a time when people like Lazarus or Peter were still around and in need of protection, which is why their names were left out of the record. Since Peter was martyred sometime around 64 AD, this suggests that the Synoptic Gospels began to circulate before this time, which places them squarely in the eyewitness period. But the fact that the fourth gospel ended up revealing the name of the high priest's servant Malchus is also worth considering. After all, how likely is it that any of Jesus' disciples would have known this man's name? And even if it happened to be uttered on the night Jesus was arrested, is it likely that anyone would remember it? But if the beloved disciple was a member of the high priest's circle, this would explain how he knew the name of Malchus. Furthermore, this theory also explains another verse that appears later in chapter 18. As Peter warmed himself by the fire, one of the high priest's servants began to ask him questions. And the narrator indicates that this man was a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off. This certainly qualifies as inside information, but again, it's something that's easily explained if the author of the fourth gospel was somehow connected to the high priest's circle. In their 2019 book, The New Testament in Its World, N.T. Wright and Michael Bird write, quote, "The Gospel of John points us to someone who, though not one of the 12, claimed nonetheless to have been an eyewitness during Jesus' public career, having perhaps been part of a priestly family familiar with the high priest." Here, of course, they're citing John 18:15, and they go on to link the suggestion to the letter of Polycrates, which in their view may perhaps rehearse the memory of John's priestly lineage. Here they're referring to the ancient letter I discussed with Richard Bauckham on the last episode, which indicated that John had been a priest who wore the high priestly crown. As a result of the way that the external and internal evidence dovetail nicely, N.T. Wright and Michael Bird then conclude that, quote, "The John behind the gospel was not one of the 12. In my own research, I've been able to trace variations of this argument as far back as 1870. In his book, The Witness of St. John to Christ, Stanley Leeds wrote, "Eusebius, in two passages, quotes from a letter of Polycrates in which he says, 'John, who rested on the bosom of our Lord, was also a priest and bore the sacerdotal plate.'" Critics have not known what to make of this sacred plate, which bore the inscription, "Holy to the Lord," but it seems not unreasonable to suppose that he was somehow connected with the priestly office, and that the circumstance at least is worth considering as tending to identify him with the disciple known to the high priest in John 18. If the tradition is worth anything, as it probably is, it does clearly show how St. John may have been not only known to the high priest, but even possibly a distant relative. As far as we can judge, he concludes, the tradition serves to corroborate the gospel, and the gospel to confirm the tradition. End quote. Folks, throughout this episode, I've been working with material that I put together in my 30-page PDF resource titled The Identity of the Beloved Disciple, which you can find information about in the show notes for this episode. In addition to the material that you've heard on this program, this new PDF resource also discusses an intriguing archaeological discovery that could help us to identify the author of the fourth gospel. As I've engaged with fellow Christians about the subject of this investigation over the years, I've discovered that challenging our assumptions about the identity of John is sometimes viewed as a kind of liberal assault on a core Christian doctrine. But in my opinion, this is simply a defensive posture that assumes, without examination, that we're already in possession of the truth. In other words, it's a kind of blind faith. Ironically, as a result of our investigation, we've arrived at a much stronger position related to the authenticity and reliability of the fourth gospel. The evidence we've uncovered suggests that this gospel was written by a disciple of Jesus who was closely connected to the high priest, and various features of this record indicate that it was drafted at a time in which his identity still required safeguarding. Though it's possible that those in the earliest Christian community would have understood references to the disciple Jesus loved, since many would have been aware of his story in that early period, particularly among those who had been made disciples by Jesus' original followers, nevertheless, for purposes of protection, when his story was told in a document intended for wide circulation, the beloved disciple's name was intentionally kept out of the record. In the case of the earlier Synoptic Gospels, his name, along with his story, were kept out of the record entirely. Once again, the best explanation for this feature of all four Gospels is protective anonymity. As J.B. Lightfoot observed, this approach is wholly unlike that of a forger. In fact, he argued, this is not only unlike a forger, it is wholly unintelligible on such a supposition. In other words, understanding this feature of the four Gospels, and the Gospel of John in particular, helps us to come to grips with the fact that the stories recorded in these narratives were not invented. These things really took place. This is real history. Folks, as always, for more information about the things mentioned on this episode, simply head to humbleskeptic.com, where you'll find all kinds of book recommendations, along with a link to download my PDF resource that I mentioned earlier titled The Identity of the Beloved Disciple. The address once again is humbleskeptic.com. That's humbleskeptic.com. And I look forward to being with you again as we discuss the beliefs and ideas that shape our lives.